Well, during the week, Josh and I were talking about Easter time and the preparation that's already underway for our Easter outreach. Now, I know it seems hard to believe that we're already talking Easter because it feels like we were only just talking Christmas. And that's because we were only just talking Christmas. And then you go through this 31 days of January, which is pretty much a blur. No one remembers what happens in January. And now we're in February. In fact, we're at the end of February, and Easter's only 6 weeks away, around about 6 weeks. And so as a church, the ministry, the outreach is already underway and getting prepared for our next big outreach, which is Easter time. And as Josh and I were talking about Easter and what it's going to look like, how it's shaping up, we couldn't help reflect on what last Easter looked like for the McKee household. Last Easter was a big Easter for us. It's the first Easter taking over as the sole pastor, so that was a lot of responsibility there. Both Josh and I were heavily prepared and involved in that service. And a couple of the days leading up to Easter time, surprise, surprise, it shouldn't be a shock. The kids were sick. They had some sort of plague, and they were runny nose and a bit feverish, but it was nothing to worry about. Michael pretty much got well, better in a couple of days, but Grace started to get worse. And it was on the Saturday night where she was just feverish and she was tired, and this is not Grace by any stretch of the imagination. We thought, well, let's just put her to bed and we'll see if a rest restores her. Come Easter Sunday, the morning of, we see Grace and she's in our bed and she's heart rate is elevated, her breathing rate was labored and elevated, she was feverish and she was limp. Now, limp is not the word we use to describe Grace. The Duracell bunny is the word we use to describe Grace. She's pinging all over the place. She's energy galore. And here she was, and that was not her at all. And I said to Josh, I don't care that it's Easter Sunday, so she needs to go to hospital. Family first. That's God's order. It's God, family, church, work, recreation. I said, so you go. I'll handle the service. There only needs to be one of us because with the restrictions at the time, they're probably only going to let one of us in. So I said, you go. You take her. I'll do the service. It will look the way it looks, and God is good, and he'll be glorified. And he was, wasn't he? We had a great time together. And after the service, I was ringing Josh to find out what was happening with Josh and Grace, and she at that point was admitted into the base hospital, and you know the rest of the story. She got better. She's here today. She got better. But as Josh and I were talking about this, he said to me, you didn't even see her when she was at her worst. He said, after I left and I took her into emergency, and we're in one of the emergency bays, he said, I was just holding her, and she was just so limp. And so not like Grace. And she was, he said, I just felt so helpless and hopeless and desperate as I watched our little girl deteriorate. And I thought as he said those, I'm like, you know what, Josh, I think that you could probably more than most relate to our desperate man today that we're going to look at, Jairus. Last week in Mark 5, we started looking at when the desperate encounter Jesus. And we started off looking at Jairus' story, his need for his daughter to be healed because she was at the point of death. But then we kind of took a side note, didn't we? We went off to the side and we focused that message on the story that happens within the story of the bleeding woman, the woman who'd been hemorrhaging for 12 years and she was desperate and she encountered Jesus and he healed her. This week we're going back to Jairus and we're going to finish Jairus' story. When this desperate man encounters Jesus. But before we jump straight into Mark 5, let's just go to Mark 4 in our Bibles, just to reorientate ourselves to the story. Mark chapter 4, starting off in verse 35. Mark 4. 35, and this is where it picks up from here. It says, on that day when evening came, he, being Jesus, said to them, the disciples, let us go over to the other side. leaving the crowd, he took him along with them in a boat as he was, and the other boats were with him. What's happened during Mark 4 is that Jesus has been teaching to the Jewish people in parables. And there's this large crowd which has gathered around. And Jesus says to his disciples, let's get away from the crowd. Let's get away from them. And let's get in a boat on Lake Galilee and let's go to the other side. The other side was the east side. It was the Gentile side. He says, let's get in a boat and let's go over to the east side, to the Gentile side. And what happens? They get in a boat. And as they're on Lake Galilee, all of a sudden, a wild storm suddenly appears. Raging winds generating these massive crashing waves. This was common on Lake Galilee because Lake Galilee was surrounded by all these mountains. And they often had these strong winds come down from the mountains and just pummel Lake Galilee. Now, I've seen recently pictures of what a storm today in modern day Lake Galilee looks like. And I've seen the pavement, which is around for people to walk, just like we have around our lake. I've seen the pavement absolutely turned upside down. These winds are strong. And on this particular day, those winds come crashing down and they generate these great winds. And remember, half of Jesus' disciples are experienced fishermen, aren't they? And even they can't handle the seriousness of this storm. And they come and they're looking for Jesus. And where's Jesus? And when all this is happening? He's asleep. He's having a snooze in the back of the boat. You know those waves that are just gently rocking him to sleep. And they come to him and they wake him up and they say, don't you care about us? We're perishing. What does Jesus do? He just gets up. Goes up to the storm and just says, hush, be still. And the storm and the wind and the waves, they completely cease. They die and there is peace once again on the lake. And Jesus says to his disciples here in verse 40, why are you afraid? Do you still have no faith? Do you still lack conviction in who I am as the Messiah, is what he's saying. And this theme of no faith, the lack of convictions that the disciples has, it now carries in to chapter 5. It carries in with the events that happen in chapter 5. And all these events that happen with the bleeding woman, with Jairus is what we're going to see, what happens over on the east side of Lake Galilee, its purpose is to build the disciples' faith. And Jesus never did anything by chance. It was to teach his disciples to have a conviction in who he was. We see that they eventually get over to the east side. This is the Gentile side, made up of 7 Gentile nations. Now, sometimes we can just read over that and think, oh, that's nice, he's over with the Gentiles. No, remember, think like a Jew. Think like a Jew. He's with Gentiles. He's ministering to Gentiles. You know, he's just not a Jewish Messiah. He's just simply the Messiah. Amen. And he goes over to the east side where all these Jews are and he encounters a demon-possessed man, a man with legions of demons in him, thousands of demons in him. And just like that, he casts them out. And the disciples, remember, are witnessing this. They've witnessed his authority over nature and now they're witnessing his authority over the demonic. They get back in that boat. They travel now back over to the west side, the Jewish side. And let's pick up from verse 31 in chapter 5. It says, when Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, back to the west side, to the Jewish side of Lake Galilee, a large crowd gathered around him. And so he stayed by the seashore. He comes back and that crowd hasn't moved on yet. They're still there. They're still waiting for a piece of Jesus. And it's so big that he's kind of backed up against the seashore. Can't go any further. But among this crowd, there is a man who is desperately seeking Jesus. And he pushes his way through to speak to Jesus. And we see his name is Jairus. It says there in verse 22, one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up to him and on seeing him fell at his feet. Jairus was a synagogue official. What does that mean? Well, he wasn't a priest. A synagogue official was a lay leader of a synagogue. Every synagogue had several lay leaders. Jairus was one of them in the synagogue at Capernaum. Everyone knew Jairus as a synagogue official in Capernaum. He had a well reputation. He had a good position in society. And his job as one of the synagogue officials was much the same as what we might see a pastor do today or a worship leader do in the modern church today. His job was to make sure the service at synagogue ran smoothly. His job was to make sure that the correct portion of reading for that day was ready to go. His job was to make sure that the person who was reading that and teaching it knew what they were doing and knew where to stand and knew what they when it was time for them to go. He had a job to make sure that the service ran smoothly. And we see this man who is very well known in the public, well known in Capernaum, comes to Jesus and he falls at his feet. This is an act of worship. He comes and he worships Jesus. Remember, thinking like Jews, only God, only Yahweh can be worshipped. What Jairus is doing is publicly recognizing Jesus' divine authority and recognizing his authority as the Messiah. That's what he's doing here. Now, how did he know he was the Messiah? Well, Jairus was an educated man. He was a godly man. He knew his Old Testament. He knew what the prophet Isaiah said about the Messiah, that he would come and he would do all these various miracles, these various signs. That was the purpose of the miracles of Jesus. It was to authenticate his messiahship. Everyone in Capernaum had seen Jesus performing these miracles. Every single person knew about Jesus. And Jairus was able to go, 1 + 1 = 2, this man has to be the Messiah. He fits the criteria. And so he comes and publicly worships him. Publicly lets that be known. And we've got to remember at this point in Jesus' ministry, he has well and truly upset the apple cart in Israel. There is an increased hostility towards Jesus by the Jewish leaders, in which Jairus is one of them. Jairus is one of the Jewish leaders. And Jairus doesn't just come and seek Jesus out publicly. He comes and publicly worships him. He took a great personal risk doing this. The tongues would have been wagging in Capernaum and beyond of what Jairus did. He took a great risk to his career, to his status by doing this. Now, you might remember there was another man who came seeking Jesus. Another man similar to Jairus, a godly man in John chapter 3. What was his name? Nicodemus. Yeah. Nicodemus came searching out Jesus because Nicodemus, like Jairus, being an intelligent man, being a godly man, was able to connect the dots and realize what Jesus was doing was messianic. So he went and saw Jesus. But what time of the day did Nicodemus come and seek Jesus? He went at night. Why? Because he didn't want to be seen by people. Nicodemus was a highly respected man in Israel. He was the head of a Jewish yeshiva of a rabbinical college. He was respected in the community. He was a member of the Sanhedrin, and he didn't want to risk anyone seeing him and having his reputation ruined. So he went by night. And Jesus all but said, I'm the Messiah to him. He revealed himself of what Nicodemus knew in his head. But at that particular time in Nicodemus' life, he could not bring himself to become a lowly disciple of Jesus, to give up the fame and the fortune, to give up the reputation. He couldn't bring himself to follow him. Now, praise God, later on, he did. He did become a follower of Jesus. But he wasn't prepared to give that up. Not Jairus, though. Jairus was prepared to give it all up, to give up his position, to give up his fame, to give up his status in society, his reputation. He was prepared to be cast out of the synagogue because there was something more important in Jairus's life than all of that. It was his little girl, his daughter, which was at the point of death. We read here in verse 23, he comes after falling at the feet of Jesus and he implores him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live." He knew that he had the authority to do it. Jesus just had to be willing. You can see the desperation in Jairus here. You know, the Jewish concept of death is utter finality. Utter finality. Now, most of them believed in a resurrection, but the idea of what happened before that point, Sheol, as Josh preached on last month, was a complete mystery to them. It was complete and utter finality to them. And he is desperate, and Jesus has just got to agree. And Jairus knows that it will be okay. And I love Jesus' response. Without any hesitation, without any questions, without any arguments, Jesus just says, "Let's go." He says, "And he went off with him, and the large crowd was following him and pressing in on him." Here we have Jairus pushing through the crowd, and Jesus is following, but all the rest of these clowns want to follow on and, I don't know, maybe witness whatever party trick they think Jesus is going to do. And they're pushing in so tightly on Jesus to the point of suffocation, is what the language suggests. You know, they are hindering his movement through this crowd. You know, time is of the essence here, isn't it? And yet there's this delay. There's this delay as they try to penetrate through the crowd. How would you be feeling if you were Jairus? Panicked. I'd be freaking out. You know, I think there would be a couple of unsanctified elbows going out to the left and to the right, and maybe a swift little kick to the ankle and the knee. I'd be clearing that crowd to try and make way to get to my child, to get Jesus to my child. And then shock of all horrors, Jesus stops following Jairus and he turns and starts ministering to this woman, this unclean outcast of a woman. Jesus turns and starts ministering to her, and that's where we picked up on the story last week, and we preached on that woman last week. I love that Jesus stops and ministers to that woman. You know, she received her healing without Jesus even consciously knowing it at the time. He knew after the power left him, but she was healed, and he didn't need to turn around and to minister to her. He could have kept on following the one in which society deemed more important, but he didn't. He turned and he came to this insignificant person in society who had no value, and he ministered to her, and he gave her value in which she had never seen in her whole life. She had never seen that type of care and compassion given to her. And he ministers to her and he heals her. How do you think Jairus would have felt after seeing Jesus heal her? What do you think that did for his faith? Would have skyrocketed. He would have been, like, if he thought, he already thought he had the right man for the job. He already acknowledged him as Messiah, but if there was a shred of doubt that Jesus could heal his daughter, all of it was gone because he just witnessed Jesus heal this woman who'd been sick for 12 years. His faith would be skyrocketed. You could put yourself in the situation here. Help you understand it, of what Jairus has gone through. He's been having to sit in this anxiety as he's seen his daughter deteriorate. Jesus has been on the other side of Lake Galilee. He can't get to him. Finally, he comes back. And then he penetrates through this large crowd. And Jesus agrees to heal his daughter. You know, the hope in his heart that would have just ignited from just the fact that Jesus agreed to doing it. And then he's pushing his way through the crowd. The anxiety is heightened again because they can't get to his daughter quick enough. And then he sees Jesus heal this woman, and his faith would have been skyrocketing. But it all comes crashing down for Jairus when in verse 35 he receives word that no parent wants to ever hear. While he, as in Jesus, was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue officials saying, "Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" That hope, that faith that was once soaring in the sky, has just been snuffed out. Utter finality in his mind. And Jesus, overhearing this, says, what was being spoken, he said to the synagogue official, he says to Jairus, "Do not be afraid, only believe." Do not be afraid, only believe. These two statements, when you dig into the original Greek, they're represented by the present imperative. And what that simply means is that an imperative is a command. It's not a suggestion to do something. It's a command with authority. It's to do something with absolute conviction in the present tense, meaning to do it and to keep on doing it. What Jesus is saying here is, "I know you're afraid, Jairus. But stop being afraid and don't keep going on being afraid." He says, "Only believe." Only believe. What is this belief? Well, it's the same belief that the bleeding woman had last week, a belief that was directed in his messianic authority. He says to him, "Just keep believing what she believed about me. Just keep on believing what you previously believed about me. Jairus, focus on me. Don't look to the left, don't look to the right. Just focus on me." How often do we need to hear that during our days, during our weeks, during our months and our years? Focus on him. Focus on the author and perfecter of our faith. Put our trust in who he is. Just keep on believing what you previously believed about him. Don't waver. Don't be afraid. Only believe. And then Jesus says to his disciples, "John, James, and Peter, come with me. The rest of you just stay here. Come with me. We're going to go to Jairus' house." Now, why did he pick those three? Seems to be a pattern of Jesus. He often takes away Peter, James, and John, leaves the other disciples behind. We see it in the Mount of Transfiguration when he revealed his kingdom glory. He did it in front of Peter, James, and John. When he went to the Garden of Gethsemane, who did he take? Peter, James, and John. Why did he do this? Was it because he didn't like the other disciples as much? So good, Lorraine. He took those three away because he had to give them a intensive discipleship course. You know, these three were going to be instrumental in the early church in Jerusalem. They were going to be instrumental in the first century building of Christendom. And Jesus only has 3 short years with them. At this point, it's even less. So he has to prepare them for what the years ahead were going to look like. All three of these men were foundational in the early church. Peter, remember at Pentecost, he preached to all those Jews, and 3,000 Jews came to Christ that day because he preached Christ and Christ crucified. He went on and wrote 1 and 2 Peter. leader of the early church in Jerusalem, John. Well, he wrote the Gospel of John. He wrote 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and he wrote the book of Revelation, the book about the end times, the revelation of who Jesus is. And James, well, we don't know much about James. We know he was one of the leaders of the early church in Jerusalem, but we don't really know much about what James did in the book of Acts, because by the time we hear about James, he's dead. Within the first 15 to 20 years of Jesus' ascension, James had been martyred. Let me tell you what, if he was martyred, it was because he was being a nuisance to Rome. Whatever he was doing in that period of time, though it may have been short-lived, it clearly upset some people. These three needed to be prepared for what Jesus had ordained them to do in future years. So he gave them this personal training. You know what's encouraging? He does the same to us today. If he calls you into a ministry, and he calls every single one of us into a form of ministry, you can guarantee he doesn't just throw us in there and say, good luck. No, he prepares us for that ministry. He puts the time in. He's faithful to make sure that we are equipped, because he does the equipping. We just make ourselves available. He does the work. He equips us. He strengthens us. It's not in our strength, it's in his. And so he takes these three for a little private lesson. And they go to Jairus' house. And they walk in, and it's on for young and old. Listen to this. And they came to the house of the synagogue official, and he saw a commotion. I think a better translation I looked into was uproar. They saw a uproar of the people loudly weeping and wailing. Who were these people? Paid wailers. They were professional mourners. It's hard to believe that this was actually a job occupation in ancient Israel, but it was. People were paid to be professional mourners. And what was really interesting is that the Pharisees actually made it mandatory based on the Mishnah, based on the laws that they thought were going to protect God's laws, that God didn't ask them to bring. The Pharisees actually said, if someone dies, everyone needs to have at least one wailing woman, one woman carrying on and tearing her clothes and throwing dust in the air. I'd do that for free, by the way. We need one woman to do that, and you need at least two flute players. Even the poorest of the poor, that's what you need to have. You know, just adding additional burdens onto Israel, weren't they? Jairus isn't a poor man. How many people do you think were at this? It would have been the whole orchestra that was there. They're not just two flute players. He would have had everyone there as they all come to weep and to carry on. It's like the monkey cage at the Melbourne Zoo, this would have been. And Jesus says to them, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. She's not dead, she's asleep, is what he says. And these clowns start laughing at Jesus. You know, how appropriate. You know, you're meant to fake that you're paid good money to fake that you're sad, and yet they're laughing at Jesus. They're mocking Jesus. What are you talking about, Jesus? Of course she's dead. She's lifeless. She's not asleep. It's interesting that Jesus so often would put the phrase dead and asleep, linking them in the same sentence. He does it in John 11, doesn't he? When his dear friend Lazarus dies. Lazarus dies, and the disciples say, Lazarus is dead. And Jesus says, no, he's not dead. He's just asleep. And the disciples, dense as they are, you know, it'd be me too. Well, if he's asleep, well, that's great. He'll get some rest. He'll get better if he's asleep. And Jesus has to say, no, he's dead. He's dead. Jesus so often put dead and asleep in conjunction with one another in the life of a believer, because he was trying to transport his disciples' understanding of death from being a Jewish understanding of utter finality to a kingdom understanding. A kingdom understanding where, for the believer, death isn't final, is it? No, it's just temporary separation from our spirit and our soul from our bodies until he gives us that glorious resurrected body. You excited about a glorious resurrected body, Nola? Yeah, I'm pretty excited too. He says she's not dead, but she's asleep, and they scorn and they mock him. They laugh at him. And then he clears the room. He says, go on, get out. He clears the room, taking Peter, John, and James, and Jairus and his wife. They go into the room where this little girl lies lifeless. In verse 31, it says, taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kum, which translates mean, little girl, I say to you, get up. What do you think happened? She got up. Immediately the girl got up and began to walk. And she was 12 years old. Immediately they were completely astonished. They were out of their mind, out of their senses of what they've just witnessed. They were breathless by what they had just witnessed. Here's their daughter who's laying lifeless, who's cold, who's dead. And now she's up walking around. Knowing she's being a kid, she's looking for some food. She's in the pantry already. You know, that'd be me. Dying's hard work. I'm hungry. No, she's up and she's moving, and they are completely astonished upon astonishment. What's interesting, it's not necessarily the fact that she has been risen from the dead which has made them so breathless by witnessing this miracle. Because remember, we're thinking like Jews when we're reading the scriptures here, particularly the Gospels. This wasn't a miracle that Israel hadn't seen done before. There were two other individuals by the power of God that resurrected people. Do you know who they are? Elijah and his predecessor, Elisha. Elijah was the first by the power of God to resurrect the widow's son. And his predecessor, Elisha, he did it twice. He did it first when he was alive, and then when he was dead, he did it by the power of God. This wasn't unheard of from Israel's perspective. But it was how Jesus did it. That was the truly astonishing part. That was the part that led them breathless. So let's go to 1 Kings 17. I want to compare how Elijah performed the miracle of resurrection and compare it to how Jesus does it here in Mark 5. 1 Kings 17. What we see here is there's been a famine in the land. Elijah has been staying with a widow and her son. She would put him up when he was in town in her prophet's quarters, and she'd care for his needs, feed him and water him. And then one day, her son, her only son, dies. Gets gravely ill and he dies. And she says to Elijah here in verse 18 of chapter 17, what do I have to do with you, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my iniquity to remembrance and to put my son to death. She thought her son died as a divine judgment upon her sin. That's how she viewed God. And Elijah says, let me see the boy. And he goes upstairs to where the boy is laying lifeless. And it says here in verse 20 that he called to the Lord. This word called means he passionately pleaded with God. And he said, O Lord, my God, have you also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die? Notice how the prophet views God. He also views it as if this is some form of divine judgment upon her sin. And then what he does is he stretches himself out on this boy three times. And each time he stretches himself upon the child, he's praying, he's petitioning God, please bring him back to life. And after the third time, the child comes back to life. Notice how Elijah had no guarantee that this was going to work. He simply interceded on behalf of the woman as the prophet of God and asked God to bring him back. Let's go back to Mark 5 and compare it to how Jesus does it. Verse 41. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Does Jesus ask permission of the Father? He just commands it. He simply commands it. And that is what they are so astonished about. Not just that he has resurrected their little girl, but the authority in which he shows in doing it. He just commands it and he's done. And it looks like that Jesus is talking to a corpse here. But let me tell you, Jesus isn't talking to a corpse at all. He's talking to the spirit and the soul in the depths of Sheol, and he is commanding her, get back in your body. And she does. She gets back in her body and immediately is walking around. And she was 12 years old. How long had the woman from last week been suffering her hemorrhage for? 12 years. The year that woman started to hemorrhage was the year that this little girl was born. 12 significant. The next chapter, we see Jesus feed 5,000 men and countless other women and children, and they take up the leftovers. And how many baskets full? 12. 12 represents the 12 tribes of Israel. Could God make it any clearer, his provision for Israel in the Messiah? I think not. I think not. And he raises this girl back from the dead and gives her back to Jairus, this desperate man, and his wife. And I can imagine there were a lot of tears that day. And what has Jesus demonstrated to his disciples over the last few days? First, his authority over nature. Then his authority over the demonic. Then his authority over illness and disease with the bleeding woman. And now he demonstrates his authority over death. I mean, that's some education in the space of a couple of days, isn't it? All for what reason? Because they had no faith. They lacked conviction in who he is. And he said, well, I'm going to show you who I am. Wow. What an education. He uses these two desperate individuals who had a strong, firm conviction in him and who he was to teach them of what type of faith they ought to have. You know, over the last 2 weeks, I have found studying this passage such a joy. It has been such an encouragement. How Jesus has met these two desperate individuals' needs. But more than that, I have found it a real challenge. I have been really convicted by this story because I follow the story of Jairus. I follow the story of the bleeding woman. And what I see is these people live a life of radical faith. They live a life of absolute conviction in who Jesus is, and they don't waver on it. If I'm being honest, I don't live by radical faith. I think if we're all honest in the room, most of us probably don't live a life of radical faith, of absolute certainty of who Jesus is. I'm so like the disciples at time when the storm's raging on. I'm looking to the left, I'm looking to the right, I'm looking everywhere else, I'm looking inwardly. I'm not looking at the author and perfecter of my faith. I'm not fixating and focused on who he is in the storm. Too often I'm like the disciples. And so I've been challenged by these two individuals to imitate their type of faith, their radical faith, their conviction of who Christ is that they cannot be wavered on. And I want to extend that challenge to you today as well. Let's get radical in our faith. Now, when I say radical faith, do not hear the word reckless faith. Because reckless faith and radical faith are not the same thing. Reckless faith is when you rush out ahead of God, you haven't sought his word, so therefore it cannot be in his will, and that ends in disaster every day of the week. But radical faith, it's got nothing to do with you. It's got nothing to do with your faith. It's about the one you have faith in. It's about him. It's directed in him. And because it's in him, it's directed in his word and his character and his will. And that ends in victory. When we have that type of radical faith, it ends in victory. So what does radical faith look like for us? Well, maybe you've been financially struggling lately. You wouldn't be the only one. Everyone is doing it tough at the moment. That's your situation. That's your desperation. That's your need. Radical faith views it as, well, who is Jesus in that struggle? Well, I'll tell you who he is. His word says it is Yahweh Yireh, the Lord of my provider, the Lord of my provision. His word says the silver and the gold is mine, so go to him. That's who Jesus is in the situation. Maybe there are broken relationships in your life, friendships, family relationships. That's the drama, that's the desperation, that's the need. Radical faith looks at that situation, it looks at who Jesus is in that. Well, if he can reconcile us to the Father, he can reconcile any one of your relationships. He can bring forgiveness, he can pour out grace and mercy, he can soften hearts. Maybe there are physical struggles in your body, mental struggles, even spiritual struggles. That's the desperation, that's the need. Radical faith views that situation. Who is Christ in that? Well, he's my healer. And by his permissive will, he can bring healing to our bodies, healing to our minds, and certainly healings to our souls. That's what radical faith looks like. Who Jesus is in our desperation. You know, your situation might not change. The things that happen in your life may not ever change. They might get worse. But I can tell you, when you look at your life through this radical faith, who Jesus is in that situation, your situation might not change, but your life will. Your life will. You will look through the perspective of who Jesus is in that situation. Out of conviction of who he is. It's not about you. It's not about me. It's not about our faith. It's all about the one we have faith in. And there is victory and there is power in that. Amen. So let's get radical about our faith.